Our next speaker is Vaughn Walker. Vaughn became U.S. District Judge for the Northern California District in February 1990. Judge Walker is a graduate of the University of Michigan. He studied law at the University of Chicago and received his J.D. from Stanford. He's been a Woodrow Wilson Fellow at the University of California at Berkeley and has worked at the Securities and Exchange Commission. He earlier clerked for Judge Robert Kelleher of the U.S. District Court in Los Angeles and was a partner at Pillsbury, Madison, and Sutro. Judge Walker is also director of St. Francis Hospital Foundation, a member of the American Law Institute, former member of the California Review Commission, president of the Lawyers Club in San Francisco, and judicial representative of the American Association Section of Antitrust Law. I'm very proud to introduce Judge Vaughn Walker.
Well, I trust you all haven't just wandered in from the Madonna concert. I think, Jim, considering the competition, we've done pretty well with this crowd.
See, we kept our clothes on, too.
Well, that never was a temptation as far as I was concerned. And I can assure you that if the audience had thought that was a possibility, it wouldn't have been a temptation for them either. I'll tell you, it's a great pleasure to be on the same platform with Jim Gray. We've been on the same platform on this issue a couple of times in the past. Jim has done a great public service in the dedication that he has brought to this issue. And the work that has gone into this book is something that those of you who have not had the pleasure of reading it should certainly get a copy and read it. It is chock full of facts and figures and arguments of the kind that you've heard him present. I spend most of my time off the bench speaking to audiences about class actions and securities litigation and issues of that kind, and those are big issues, without any question. But this is a really big issue, the drug war and what is happening to the United States, what is happening to the world as a result of the failed policies that are described in Jim's book. And he has done great public service in bringing attention to the failures of our policies, articulating, as he has this evening, the problems associated with those policies, and pointing the way toward some solutions. He's outlined for you the points of the indictment against the war on drugs, the fact that it has created interest groups that support this policy in a sort of a perpetual motion machine of public policy. They fund one group after the other, and that group then provides political support for these policies. The prison guards union and the care providers that are supported by the appropriations, the various government agencies that receive money as a result of the war on drugs, all are creating vested interests in the continuation of this policy. Jim quite rightly described it as the eminently fundable drug war, and indeed it is. He described the erosion of our civil liberties that has gone with the policies that have been created. He's described very graphically how the war on drugs policies have encouraged, rather than discouraged, the spread of drugs and have brought more and more people who would not otherwise have been exposed to drugs into exposure to them. So, I thought in light of his comments and the thoughtful observations that he's made in his book, I might spend just a few moments talking to you about how we got here, how we got to a position where our public policies were so wrong-headed, and spend a few moments on, as Jim did, on how we might get out of this morass, this mess. And if you'll pardon me a personal observation, I never, before I went on the bench, gave any serious sustained thought to the issue of drug policy. I will not, like Jim, disclaim never having used drugs. I don't see how anybody who went through the 60s at places like Berkeley and Chicago and the University of Michigan can possibly have gotten through that experience without exposure to some narcotic substances, but it wasn't very much. And I didn't much like it, and didn't obviously find these were gateway drugs, which is, of course, one of the myths that is peddled. Marijuana is not a gateway drug to anything, as far as I can determine, except, in my case, not marijuana. I didn't like it, and I didn't respond very favorably to it. But indeed, with the exception of deciding that I didn't like these substances, I had not given any sustained thought to the policies that we had until I went on the bench. And my first few trials, I had the reaction which I suppose anyone who had not been exposed to these policies would have. The people who were the defendants, and the people that you found in court were certainly not the most likable kinds of people that typically you'd want to encounter. Most were not the kind of folks that you'd want to invite home for dinner. And so it just was something that was most unattractive, and of course you would hear the evidence in these cases. And it painted a dreary scene indeed. Then I began to realize that one of the reasons this scene was so dreary is that everybody in the courtroom was one of these characters. The witnesses for the prosecution, by and large, were people who had been drug dealers or people who were snitches of one kind or another, undercover agents or confidential informants, CIs as they're called in the trade. And pretty soon their realization came to pass that there really was not a hell of a lot of difference between the good guys and the bad guys in these cases, which was driven forcefully home to me when I went down to the judge's dining room in our courthouse one day and encountered Judge Schnocke, who was then alive. Those lawyers here who may recall Judge Schnocke would, I'm sure, never confuse Judge Schnocke with a judge who was soft on crime. And he was a rather abrupt gentleman of many years. He became a great good friend, and I thought was a fine jurist. But he could be taciturn at best. And he said, "Well, what are you doing today?" And I said, "Well, I'm trying an armed bank robbery case." "Well, how's it going?" he said. "Well, it's going just fine. As a matter of fact, I sure like this case a great deal better than these drug cases I've been trying." "Well, of course," he said, "because in an armed bank robbery case, the witnesses are nice people." And so it is. In an armed bank robbery case, the witnesses are the bank teller or the person who's in the bank who's putting money in or taking money out, or a customer coming or going, or the guard and so forth. And there are people who suddenly find themselves in the middle of a bank robbery at the wrong end of a gun, or they're witnessing some sort of a crime. They have no interest or incentive in the case other than to tell the truth, to tell what happened as they saw it. They have no stake in the outcome other than to see that justice is done. So the witnesses in those kinds of cases where there are those kinds of crimes charged are nice people. But a drug case is altogether different. A drug case is not self-revealing. What is going on is an activity that can't possibly be prosecuted except by surreptitious law enforcement. And as a consequence, it turns out that in a drug case, unlike on our bank robbery case, the witnesses typically are not nice people. And the government has to deal with such individuals, has to spread money around, give favorable consideration of one kind, leniency, or some other kind of favorable treatment. in order to secure testimony in those kinds of cases. And so someone who's never been exposed to these kinds of cases in the past, as I had not, begins to realize the character of the kind of law enforcement that is entailed in prosecuting drug cases. And then you begin to realize, as you spend a little more time on the bench and you watch how the criminal laws operate, that law enforcement is very much, as Thomas Jefferson said, or as Thomas Edison said of invention. Recall, he said that invention is 99% perspiration and 1% inspiration. Well, you learn, after being on the bench, that law enforcement is 99% compliance and about 1% coercion. If you have laws that people are unwilling to obey, to comply with, then you're going to have to resort to the kinds of law enforcement measures that you see in drug cases. And the fact of the matter is, in our drug laws, that there is a segment of our population that simply is unwilling to comply with the aspirations that these laws represent. The law's hopes and aspirations exceed the population's ability and willingness to grasp. And so, to try to bring these things together, the government has to engage in undercover enforcement, coercive methods of law enforcement, and the kinds of policies and practices that have led to the bizarre and disturbing results that Jim Gray has described. The history of drug law enforcement goes back a long way. The problem that we find ourselves in is not one of recent invention, and it's not one that's one that you can lay at the feet of one party or the other. You can't lay it at the feet of liberals or conservatives or people of a particular political point of view. What you can lay it at the foot of is an unwillingness of people to rise above themselves. Here's what I mean. The first narcotics law that was enacted in the United States was enacted in good old liberal San Francisco in the middle of the 19th century, when this area was bringing in increasing numbers, Asians to work primarily on the railroads and other public improvements. And naturally, they brought in practices and customs of their homelands, which included the use of opium. And it was thought by the good folks of San Francisco that this was corroding the morals of San Francisco, and we had to stamp out the opium dens of San Francisco. And an ordinance in that city was passed. And at the same time, the country was in the throes of trying to deal with the alcohol problem. One of the interesting phenomena about alcohol is there is no substance that has a better track record than alcohol. The data series that's available on consumption of alcohol in the United States far surpasses that of any other substance. The reason for that is that we've attempted to tax that over such a long period of time. And one of the interesting facts about alcohol consumption in the United States is that it reached a high point in the early to mid part of the 19th century. Alcohol consumption on a per capita basis in the United States reached its peak at the period between about 1820 and 1840. We know this because of the data which is available and the population figures which are also available. The tax records that are available and the import data that are available. And historians believe, and I think this makes a great deal of sense, that the reason for this is that at about that time in history, the country, European settlers were crossing the Appalachians and the Allegheny Mountains and settling in the rather broad, rich agricultural lands of Ohio and Indiana and somewhat later in Illinois, land that was great for growing grain. But it was still hard to get grain from the grain-producing regions of the country to the Atlantic seaboard, where the vast bulk of the population lived. If you had to ship grain in whole, you had to ship it all the way down the Ohio or Mississippi River, down to New Orleans, and then around back up to the East Coast. Or alternatively, you could distill it into an alcoholic substance and ship it much more economically to the East Coast. And so that, together with the fact that virtually every farm in the country in that area west of the Allegheny and west of the Appalachians, had a still, certainly any farm of any substance had a still, there was an abundance of low-priced corn liquor available, and alcohol was very widely consumed, and it was a problem, as it is a problem today. We know the problems that attend alcohol addiction and alcohol abuse, and the same problems existed in the early to middle parts of the 19th century. And that, of course, gave rise to the temperance movement and the prohibition movement. Both of my grandmothers were members of the Women's Christian Temperance Union. And Lord knows what they would think of their grandson going around giving speeches on the subject that I'm speaking on tonight. But one of them, bless her heart, according to my mother, about 10 o'clock in the morning would have a little glass of Sauterne wine, which she thought was very helpful in thinning her blood. But yet she would hitch up the wagon and go around the countryside, rounding up people to vote to make sure that the county that she lived in remained dry. But there was the temperance movement at that time. It was obviously directed to a real social problem, the problem of alcoholism. But it was also accompanied by the influx at that time of a large number of Irish immigrants into the country. Basically, a Protestant country at that time, the Irish were basically Catholic. And there was a great deal of feeling that there was an association between the influx of the Irish who were coming in, and the Irish who were coming in at that time were not the gentry of that country. They tended to be a little rougher than around the edges than some of the old settlers thought, and they concentrated in the big cities, and many of the social phenomena that we associate with urban concentrated populations existed with the influx of Irish immigrants in that part of the 19th century. And there became kind of a tie between those, or an association in the popular mind. The famous comment of James G. Blaine of Romanism and Rebellion, linking these phenomena. And so people associated a particular group and a real social problem, and they began to respond. And that, of course, led to the increased temperance movement, which, as we all know, peaked ultimately in the early part of this century, with the early part of the last century, with the prohibition, the legal prohibition movement. And together in 1914 gave us the Harrison Act, which was directed towards substances other than alcohol, kinds of substances that are illegal today. An enactment during the Woodrow Wilson administration, and vigorously enforced by the Woodrow Wilson administration, who an administration which engaged in that era's war on drugs with the same enthusiasm that some of the later administrations have joined in. And then the 1937 Anti-Marijuana Act, a product of the Franklin Delano Roosevelt New Deal, motivated to a considerable degree by fear associated with the use of marijuana, which was associated with a tremendous influx at that time into the Southwest and the southern states of migrants from Mexico, who were thought to be bringing this scourge into good old America. And then we've seen in more recent times the tremendous increase in penalties associated with the distribution of crack cocaine as opposed to, or distilled cocaine as opposed to powdered cocaine. And that, as we know in the popular mind, is an association between blacks and this substance. The thought being that somehow or other this is a more lethal and more threatening form of the substance, and we associate that, or people, it's been associated in the public minds with a particular segment of our population. In fact, of course, the truth is that crack is a phenomenon of the drug wars. As the drug wars were making cocaine more expensive, lower income people were able to get more bang for the buck by distilling it, and developed means of doing that through the development of crack. My point in describing this is not only to suggest that there is a racial or ethnic component with our drug laws, because I think there is an unthinking association. Fear of the foreign, a fear of the minority that has given us the drug laws as they presently exist. I don't think many of those who sincerely have supported these laws are themselves racist, or that the laws are at bottom racist in their intentions. But the problems, of course, had their origins in much deeper phenomena than simply drugs. But drugs became a popular whipping boy for the politicians, and they continue to be a whipping boy for politicians, and explain the kinds of comments that Judge Gray has referred to by former Congressman Hutchinson, in which he described the war on drugs not as public policy, but as a crusade. It is that mentality, it seems to me, that we need to address and to try to bring into a more rational focus. But it's going to be a very long and hard row in order to accomplish that. There is, I think, no simple or easy answer. There isn't a law that can be passed that's going to solve the problem. There isn't even a set of laws that's going to solve the problem. It's going to take more speeches by Jim Gray. It's going to take more books by Jim Gray. It's going to take more symposia such as this. It's going to be a long, hard struggle. Marsha Rosenbaum, who Judge Gray mentioned, has been toiling in this vineyard for a long time, and there's no end in sight. I do think there is progress. I do think people have begun increasingly to appreciate the futility of the policies that we have pursued, and are beginning to understand the less noble motivations or less noble fears that have driven these policies over the years. But we're going to have to face the fact that this is a problem that's going to be with us, or the set of problems is going to be with us for some long period of time. And in the meantime, the policies that we have been pursuing are almost, seems to me, completely upside down. If you consider the adverse social effects of drugs, or the drug war, and the policies that we have, those policies exacerbate the problems to a considerable degree. What we have attempted to do is to engage in an interdiction policy to keep drugs out of the country, to focus our enforcement efforts on the drug kingpins, the big sellers of these commodities. And you sometimes hear people seeming to take a moderate position by saying, well, we should focus on the big guys, the drug kingpins, but let the small users, the small dealers off the hook. I must say that I think that is completely wrong, completely the opposite of what makes sense under these circumstances. If anything, the enemy is the drug dealer who is on the street corner, who's corrupting kids on their way to school, who are peddling drugs in the schoolyards, who are doing the sorts of things that Judge Gray has talked about, of luring in more and more people into drug use, of creating the collateral violence associated with drug transactions on street corners and in neighborhoods throughout the country. The problem is not that the country is awash in drugs. It already is awash in drugs. The problem is created by the fact that drugs are a profitable enterprise for these criminals to engage in. And the incentives to engage in the drug trade overwhelm the ability of many people to resist. And that's why you have on the street corners of the country and in the schoolyards of the country all of these drugs being peddled. It would make much more sense to focus law enforcement efforts at the local level and to turn away from trying to do the impossible in any event, and that is to keep the drugs out of the country in the first place. The problem is not unlike many other law enforcement problems which exist when the aspirations of the law exceed the grasp of society to comply. At some point or other in that situation, we all know it, law enforcement turns a blind eye. Law enforcement doesn't really go after houses of prostitution in certain areas. They let them flourish. They confine prostitution to certain neighborhoods, if they possibly can. They know they can't pass more rational laws on the subject, and so over the years, we've accepted a kind of a compromise in which we allow that activity, which is a harmful activity without any question, and a problematic one, but nevertheless one that is another area in which the aspirations of the law exceed the grasp of society to comply. And so we've adopted what is a much more rational approach. We allow it to go on in certain areas, under certain circumstances, as long as it's confined. And I suggest to you that until we can begin to have some of the longer range solutions that Judge Gray has outlined, a far more rational way for law enforcement to deal with the current narcotics problem is to treat it as we treat similar activities in which our ability to comply with the laws does not live up to the aspirations of those laws. Now, David is trying to get me off, trying to shut me down. I want to say just one other thing. It's always a great pleasure to be on the same platform with Judge Gray. I knew his father, who was a great jurist in Southern California, and I know what a splendid job Jim has done on this issue over the years, and it's always an opportunity and a pleasure to see and be with David Thoreau, and I know the great good works that he does. But I must tell you, what gives me greater pleasure than anything else tonight is the presence here of two individuals who have been real veterans in the war on drugs. I'm not going to point them out or mention them by name, but they're two men who have appeared before me when I was wearing a black robe, who were defendants in drug cases. And in their cases, I tried to apply the law consistent with the oath that I took, to apply the law fairly and consistent with its intention, but also, I hope, with some understanding of the circumstances that they faced. Judges increasingly find that hard to do. The laws that we have enacted constrain the ability of judges to apply the law in a humane way, a way that tries to recognize the circumstances and the characteristics of the offender and the possibilities and potentials which those offenders have. Once in a while, with a little struggle and an occasional reversal by the Court of Appeals, you can do that. And I must say that the presence here of these two gentlemen, they obviously know who they are and so forth, gives me the greatest pleasure to know that they have gone through this war. They are survivors. They are veterans. They have paid a terrific price. They both have straightened out their lives and have straightened out what they're doing in society, and their recognition by being here this evening is one of the greatest rewards that I could possibly have in the years that I've been on the bench. And so I thank them, and I thank you for your patience and your attention.